Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard joining me, and you are listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. You count on WPR's Ideas Network for talk about issues that matter to you. And of course, we count on you to help keep those discussions on the air. So make a gift, any amount right now. Help us pay for the programs you depend on. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And Jim, we always have pledge goals.
Indeed we do. Last hour, the goal was 50 pledges, and we heard from 15 pledges. This hour, we have a goal of 70 pledges. So these goals are extremely important. They help us stay on track with the funds that are necessary to keep the discussion going on at Wisconsin Public Radio. So take a moment right now and give at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be talking to Phil Pelletieri, Phil, extension entomologist with the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And of course, we talk about insects when he's on and always get lots of calls. And discussions like this on the Ideas Network are possible because of your financial support. I hope you'll give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. You can get an Ideas Network mug for your pledge of $150. Beautiful mug. The important thing is to make a gift, any amount right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
You know, supporting Wisconsin Public Radio is the best thing that you can do with 3 minutes of your time. You give us your name, contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. That's all that it is. Whether you call or pledge online, we keep your personal information safe. Your gift right now will turn into the programs and the stories that will keep you connected to the world. So give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
You know, Phil Pelletieri is a great guest, and we get such good guests on WPR because they know that you are going to ask great questions, and they won't be interrupted by commercials. Your support makes this possible. You're the most reliable part of our budget. So thanks in advance for making your pledge at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
We know you're donating because you value the radio programs that you hear on WPR, and we're very pleased to be able to give you something a little extra for your support, the WPR member card. For your pledge of $120, we think you're going to enjoy this card, which gives you two-for-one entrees at participating restaurants and two-for-one deals at B&Bs, golf courses, cultural attractions around the state. You'll find value in the card all year, just as we value your support all year. So pledge $120 or more, and the member card is yours. Go to WPR.org. Or at 888-202-2552.
And
what were you going to say, Larry?
Yeah, I was going to say we already have our first contributor, so we've got one of the 70. We only have 69 to go, so help us out here. Give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. You could consider becoming a sustaining member. You do that by making an automatically renewing monthly contribution. You can do it from your bank account or your credit card. The more sustainers we have, the more stable we are. And to thank you, we'll plant a tree in Wisconsin on your behalf if you become a sustaining member. So pledge now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. One comment. Susan from Boulder Junction says, I love having a local radio station with great programming. Thanks for all you do. That's wonderful. Thank you, Susan. And thanks to you for your contribution. Give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And we're going to talk to Phil Pelletieri for a while now. Phil, good to see you.
Nice to be here.
We have you figured out the formula for getting rid of bed bugs in this country?
Well, in this country, yes.
You'd be a millionaire.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. It's probably been getting more press than they deserve in the last 2 or 3 weeks. The press seems to be enamored, but this has been an ongoing problem for at least the last 10 to 12 years, and a lot of it relates to the insects are pretty much resistant to the common sprays that are used indoors. But the other thing is that culturally, you know, we have not dealt with this for the last 5 or 6 decades, so most of us don't know what to look for, don't understand. You've got to be careful with used furniture and those kind of things as a way of them bringing in.
Well, lots of callers online, so we're going to take some calls. Mo in Milwaukee up first. Mo, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I'm calling about is the spider I've come to call Samson, or Sam, because he's so large. And I don't know if it's a he or a she, but it's the largest spider I've had in my backyard here. It is from hind legs to front legs, probably an inch and a half. And they have six long legs that are banded, orange, black, and then two of the smaller feeder. I don't want to call them legs, but they're one half the size, and they look like they're...
But they have to be legs, because spiders have eight pairs, or eight legs, four pairs.
Okay.
Now, it's an orb weaver spider. They are always very colorful. They have the banded legs. A lot of them, the abdomen looks like a marble, and it might be orange in color with white markings. It might be brown with light tan and black. I mean, they're really very pretty.
Pretty.
Gorgeous.
And I can guarantee you it's a female. The females are much larger than the males.
Okay.
And as the name implies, they make a web that they use to catch their prey. They're totally harmless, but they're not the biggest, but they're among some of the bigger spiders we see here. And they're very common in the late summer and early fall. What they will do is lay an egg sac, and that's how the spider gets through the winter, and the little baby spiders will hatch next spring. And they make great photographic subjects. It's interesting. I must have had 7 or 8 emails with various orb weaver spiders in there.
In between my screen and my crank-out window. So when I close it, I'm going to smush her.
Well, I mean, honestly, you can get in there with a small broom or something and just kind of tease her out so she can make her web somewhere else. That would be one option. I think if you do nothing, I'm guessing within the next 2 or 3 weeks that she'll probably die. That's kind of the normal pattern, is by the 1st of November or so, things are pretty much shut down.
Yeah.
But the egg sac will be intact over winter.
Right. And it's usually a dull grayish brown in color, rather small. And it looks like a little cocoon. Might be a good way to describe what it would look like.
Okay, I know what it is then. All right.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Mo. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Ray in Brownsville. Let's see. First, I have to push the button. Ray, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hey, had another spider-related question, actually. I was wondering as to how aggressive, where are they located, and how common are they in terms of brown recluses in the state? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Here's a case where you got to be careful on the internet, because you get a lot of information that really doesn't hold up. They are not considered native to Wisconsin. In the 32 years of running the lab, I have seen 4 cases of brown recluse spiders being found. What it has been found is a lot of the cases that have been diagnosed with these ulcerated bites turn out to be MRSA, the staph infection, and not spider bites. And they're really non-aggressive. And when people are looking for detailed information on brown recluse, what I suggest, there is a researcher out of California by the name of Rick Vetter, who has published extensively on recluse and trying to set the record straight. And you can go to Rick's site. If you just do Vetter and spiders, I'm sure you'll get his site. But one of the papers he had written was a family down in St. Louis, which is an area we'll find in Missouri and Arkansas and the like, the spider normally. And the family caught over 1,600 spiders in a 6-month period of time in their farmhouse.
1,600 brown recluse.
Brown recluse. And nobody ever got bit. You know, so they really are not very aggressive by nature. And as I said, so there's a confusion that a lot of misdiagnosed bites and the like, you know, but yet if you go on the internet, you will read story after story that just sound like a science fiction movie. And as I said, what it seems to be, definitely in Wisconsin, I can easily say it is not a native spider, and you just aren't going to run into it. In the endemic areas, even there, as I said, it probably gets blamed for a lot more than it's really responsible for.
All right, there you have it. Don in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. We had the threat of a severe frost last week, and I harvested everything above ground that was there, and it included a good quarter bush or third of a bushel of tomatillos. I got these things into the basement. They sat overnight. The next day I was sorting them out, and a couple of critters ran out. They run fastest, all get out. But it's about three-quarters to a little more in length. It's a dark red rust color. It's, I think, definitely an insect. It has a small head with a couple of antennas, a small thorax with six legs, and then there's a disproportionate, seems disproportionately elongated, oval-shaped abdomen at the end of which are two horn-like features, which I assume are oviducts or clasping tools, whatever. But anyway...
Would you define them as like pincers almost?
Yes.
Okay, it's an earwig. Earwigs are non-native. The species we have here is from Europe. They are interesting because they are both plant and animal feeders. I tease that they are like a goat. They'll eat anything. And they cause some minor damage on marigolds and a few other plants. Coming indoors is a dead end for them because there's nothing to eat and breed. They only have one generation a year. They spend the winter as adult females in the ground. In the spring, they literally raise their young in the ground for the first 4 or 5 weeks. And about Memorial Day, they come out and feed mostly at night. So I think they were probably looking in those sheltered areas, and they're really going to be very short-lived. They really don't pose any problems. You know, one of the things, though, is people talk about them, you know, crawling in your ear and the like. And it's interesting, even though we've talked about this on the show before, but this year I know of at least 4 or 5 cases where people had to go to physicians and have one removed. And I mean, that's not the norm. It's just that when the sun comes up, they're looking for just places to hide. And usually it's under a flower pot or a rock. And in these very rare instances, they crawl into somebody's ear. And you would think you'd put a little oil or something and you could get them out pretty easy. But at times, people have had a little bit more difficulty with them. But definitely nothing to worry about here. And what I'm seeing is they're becoming more commonplace in the Northwest, in the far northern part of the state. They've been established down in the southeastern part of Wisconsin for over 30 years.
For a long time, but Eau Claire is now experiencing them.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Thank you very much for calling. You can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as we talk insects with Phil Pelletieri, we turn our attention back to the phones and to Lisa in Cable, Wisconsin. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am one of the people who's freaked out by this bed bug infestation.
Okay.
The media's gotten to me. Anyway, we're going on vacation to Florida, and I guess there's a big problem down there with it. And I was just wondering, is there anything like that I could put in my luggage to keep the bugs from going into my luggage, like bay leaves keep beetles out of kitchen cabinets?
Yeah, there are no repellents that I know of. I think what you need to be careful of is where you store your suitcase. And to be honest, it is a very valid thing to consider leaving it in the bathroom or even the bathtub, because there's not going to be any bed bugs in that environment.
Oh.
The way that you tend to bring them in is if you put your suitcase next to the bed and leave it there, bed bugs crawl around at night and hide in places in the day, and that's the way people pick them up. And so just getting the suitcase off the floor helps a lot. Keep it away from the bed, but as I said, I think I would take it the step farther is keep your suitcase in places where you don't expect bed bugs and you shouldn't have a problem with transporting them. Now, the other side of it is just look, when I go to a hotel, I will lift up the sheets and look for any activity along the piping of the mattress. I also look on the headboard for any sign. And if you don't see any signs, and again, you take those precautions, I don't think you've got anything to worry about.
Great. So if I wouldn't see them on the mattress or the headboard, they more than likely don't have them?
Right. It turns out that, you know, when the numbers get high, you can find them almost anywhere. But initially, 70 to 80% of the population will be on the mattress, the box spring, or the frame of the bed. They're usually close where the host is. And that's why I said there's no reason for them to be in the bathroom, because that's really not a good place to pick up a meal if you're a bed bug.
Great tip. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Betty in Poinette, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to ask about some insects I saw on common milkweed this late summer that I don't remember seeing before. There were two different ones. They seemed to be on the plant simultaneously. At least they looked different to me. One was approximately the shape and size of a box elder bug, and it was also black and orange, but it had more of a, I would say, black and orange diamonds pattern on its wings, and the other had a hard shell. It was also black and orange. And my other question in regard to that is, could these possibly eat the eggs that the monarchs may be leaving on?
Yeah, in both cases, no. The first critter you described is called the milkweed seed bug.
Huh.
And it is related to box elder bugs. It's a little bit more orange. Real box elder bugs are a little bit more reddish. The hard-shelled critter, I suspect, there is a milkweed leaf beetle in the family Chrysomelidae. And so both of these are plant feeders. In the case of the leaf beetle, they chew on the leaves. In the case of the milkweed plant bug, they have a sucking mouth part that they use to feed on the seeds. They literally digest the starches and bring it in. So, and they're exclusive to milkweed, just like the monarch. They're tied into that plant. They don't do on things other than things that are in the milkweed family. But again, they pose no problems to monarchs, which, by the way, this is a pretty good monarch year. This was a better butterfly year than I have seen in a while. Last year was so pathetic, and
lots of them this year.
Yeah, we raised about six of them off our butterfly weed in the front of the house alone. So,
well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Jim in Greenwood, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We've got a family of wasps that have gotten into our. We have a fieldstone foundation on our house. It's an old house, and right up by the top of the foundation, by the mortar, they found a little opening in there, and they're in got into the. They're actually in the basement, but I've got them cordoned off so they can't actually get in there. But there's, they're coming and going like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And just wondering, how do I deal with that? What's the best way?
Sure.
To?
One of two thoughts. I mean, we're getting late enough; they will die out and will not come back by the 1st of November. They literally starve to death. It's not so much the cold, but they have no food stores, and when it gets too cold and there's no bugs out there for them to get.
Okay.
So if it's in a place that hasn't caused too much trouble, you can just let it be. The biggest mistake you could make is to plug the outside hole without dealing with them, because that will force them into the basement, and then you've got a more difficult issue. On the other side, if you need to treat, my advice to anything that goes in the ground or goes into a wall is not to use a spray, but to use a dust. It has to do with the formulation. And if you dust that entrance so that when they come and go, they have to crawl through the dust, that will do them in. A common garden dust is 7, S-E-V-I-N, but there are other products like Delta Dust and the like. And as I said, if it was the 1st of September, I'd probably say, you got another 2 months of it, it's probably worth it. But right now, it's a bit of a toss-up because, as I said, their population has been in decline at least for 3 or 4 weeks, I would guess, and will continue to be in decline. And again, the only concern would be is if they get mixed up sometimes, and you do see some of this filtering into the house. And as I said, so if you needed a quick fix, I'd wait until about 7 o'clock at night, dust that entrance, and then you should be done by the next morning.
Okay, but otherwise, they'll just die out naturally. Then
all right.
And over winter.
Right, and they have no allegiance to the nest, so the new queens that start nest next year start from scratch and won't come back, so there's no problem there.
Where does the new queen, where do they start up from then if they die out over the winter?
Well, they tend to disperse, and they'll crawl in a wood pile or under a rock or some other sheltered place, or sometimes you even find they'll crawl up in the attic and just, they're just laying low all winter long, okay. And then the first wasps that you see in the spring, I can guarantee you they're queens, and it's interesting because they're inseminated this fall. And they literally store the sperm all the way till next year and then utilize it when they need. And wasps and bees have this unique ability that if they fertilize an egg, it will transform into a female. If they don't fertilize an egg, it turns into a male.
Oh.
And males, honestly, are only produced in the late summer for mating purposes. They're really not an important part of the normal wasp colony behavior.
Are the females larger?
Slightly, but it's subtle. I mean, if you had a queen next to a worker, you could tell the size, but it really is quite subtle.
Okay. All right. That's good. Well, I appreciate it. It's a great show, and we pledged a couple of days ago trying to get it one day more, but didn't quite work. But
well, you did. Thank you so much for pledging and for calling, Jim.
Okay, and thank you. Great show. Always a great show.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Well, we have some more calls. Nice comment from Jim. Let's go to Mark in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to my brother-in-law and his fishing partner about some small bugs that accosted him when they were fishing up in Canada. And one of the guys said, yeah, and he had just had a couple of them bite him on the Wisconsin River. So So yesterday we were sitting on the tower in front of our house, and the ladybugs were coming up pretty badly. And sure enough, these little pups showed up, and they're amazingly small. They're like the size of a fleck of pepper, and they pretty much start chowing on you the minute that they land. Put one under 10-power magnification. They're conical with a little bit of a raised back. They smash fairly easily. It's not a no-see-em. I'm familiar with those. But do you have any reports of any new biting bug in the area here?
Well, one of the thoughts, I get at this time of the year a complaint about something that's not a blood feeder. It's called a minute pirate bug. And minute pirate bugs are predators on insect eggs and the like. But be darned, if they land on you, they'll nip you. You know, in certain years, we've got them all over the place. And so, you know, if you can rule out no-see-ems and black flies, because those would be blood-feeding gnats that you'd have to deal with, I would be real suspicious. They are quite small. As the name implies, if you do a search on it, you'll see that they're mostly black, but they've got a little bit of a silver spot along the back, if you see one up close.
Yeah, that would be him.
Yep.
We've never heard of him before. How come? What is it about this year that encouraged him?
Well, you know, with insects, I've learned a long time ago. I mean, there's some things I try to predict. This year, I was sure there's going to be no box elder bugs because they don't do well in wet years, and Phil was not very smart on this
one.
No. And so it's just, this has been, in general, a good year for insects. I mean, my specimen load in the lab is up about 18% versus last year. And so it's just things have went right for them. There's probably a lot of insects for them to prey on. And being predators, they do quite well.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And actually, John in Chautauqua was wondering if this unusually wet year is responsible for the box elder bug population. But that's usually not the case.
Yeah. What's the box elder bug is a native insect, and it's controlled by a fungus disease, typically. That's what makes or breaks them. And the fungus disease is not present when it's dry, so there's lots of box elder bugs. But typically, it's been wet enough that I was expecting more problems. But I'll be honest, I've talked to a couple of pest control companies in the area, and they tell me it is just horrendous, the box elder bug calls they're getting. And people have sent me some pretty neat pictures of tree trunks that are all red and black and in color and the like. So I've seen them in heavier than I'm seeing this year. But as I said, I have really been quite surprised that their populations are strong considering the weather patterns.
There you go. Well, this is Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive. Larry Mueller here, Jim Packer joining us once again. And as a regular listener to this program, you know you're always going to hear something worthwhile. Phil does a wonderful job, as do our other guests. And today, we're going to ask you to put a value on this program. Your contribution is vital to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a big part of what keeps us going, frankly. So I hope you'll support this program and everything else you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio by making a gift, any amount, at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552. Jim, we've made a little progress.
We have indeed, Larry. Five people have called to make their pledge during the last half hour, including Richard from Sturgeon Bay, who pledged, said he supports every year, and we appreciate that. We're looking for 65 more pledges in the next 30 minutes, so this is what keeps us on track to support the programs that you count on every day. Thanks if you've already given, and if not, well then give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. You know, you decide the amount of your pledge. Nobody's going to do that for you. You figure out what's necessary for you and ask for an Ideas Network mug when you give $150. Pledge now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
We usually don't give our opinions on the air, but when we talk about Wisconsin Public Radio, we kind of make an exception. I'll make an exception with this mug, too. It's a pretty nice mug, ceramic and really a beautiful mug. We'll talk more about that later. We are not afraid to say that we think WPR is a unique radio service. It's a service well worth your support. Take a moment to voice your opinion right now by making a pledge of support at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. It is a great mug.
Larry, I know there are many reasons why a Wisconsin Public Radio listener becomes a Wisconsin Public Radio contributor. One of the main reasons is that they want to make a difference. Giving to Wisconsin Public Radio is one way to make a difference and to help the entire state. Your membership today not only pays for the programs you listen to, it provides other people in your neighborhood the chance to discover WPR. So make the difference. Give at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
We have a reputation for quality and substance, I think, at WPR. And your contributions in the past have gotten us up to this point, as a matter of fact. And your pledge today will take this kind of strength into the future. Your dollars give Wisconsin Public Radio the means and methods to keep the quality and substance that you count on in our programs, you know, virtually every day. So please pledge now. Pledge your support now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
The easiest way to make sure that your support for WPR is always current is to become a sustaining member. Becoming a sustainer means that your gift, be it $5 a month, $100 a month, or anything in between, automatically renews each year. Being a sustainer means no more renewal notices in the mail, and it helps Wisconsin Public Radio save money, which makes your contribution go even further. So make the switch, make a difference at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And being a sustainer is such a great thing to do that we'll say thanks by planting a tree in Wisconsin on your behalf.
As a matter of fact, we plant those trees in the Shawamigan National Forest, a place that I've spent many, many, many days. It's a beautiful area, and what a great gift to the people of Wisconsin and this country if you become a sustaining member. So give now, WPR.org, or at 888-202-2552. Still have 65 contributions to go to reach our goal for this hour. With your pledge of $150 a week, go ahead and ask for an Ideas Network 20th anniversary mug, eco-friendly. It's reusable, obviously, and a responsible gift, I think, as well. So pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Larry, you know, when you think about it, in the last few years, how far they've come with the technology to make a mug keep warm for a long period of time. I mean, here we've got a silicone lid with a double wall porcelain mug that traps the air for insulation, and you can keep things hot or cold. Has a silicone stopper, prevents water from entering the hollow cavity when washing the cup. It's really the Cadillac of mugs, and it's available with your pledge.
And your pledge, you can make it at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. Please do it. Do it right now while you're listening to Phil. Phil's already here to answer some more questions, and there are more callers online. So let's go to Karen in Boulder Junction. Karen, hello.
Hi there. I have a question. I have a log cabin that was built in 1944. I put an addition onto one side, which includes a screened-in porch. And this time of year, but when the sun gets out in there and it gets nice and warm, I have an overabundance of flies, and I don't know where they're coming in at. And I don't know if they're hatching somewhere in there.
No, in fact, the good news is I know what it is. The bad news is I wish we would have talked a month ago.
Oh.
There's a critter that looks very much like a house fly, but we call it a cluster fly. Under the microscope, what makes them quite easy to identify is they have a very fine yellow hair that reminds me of corn silk, which I don't see normally on other species of flies, but they're... They breed in the summer on earthworms, so they're a parasite of earthworms. And so it's been a lush year, and so that doesn't surprise me the number's up. But typically about the first week of September, they start looking for sheltered places to spend the winter. And they'll crawl in any kind of crack and crevice they can. And if it stays cool, they stay dormant. But when the sun comes out, they wake up. And so that's what I think you're seeing. Now, so I know they're not breeding there, but if you've got a nice southern exposure and mm-hmm. there's a lot of places to crawl in, you can have tremendous numbers. So sometimes people refer to these as winter flies because if they get in a heated home, you even see them in January and February on a nice warm day.
Oh, okay.
So the way we stop them, honestly, is to spray the outside of the structure before they start coming in. And that's why I'm nervous that it's late enough now. They're already into places that I can't get the spray to.
Sure.
Okay.
Now, you will see it ebb and flow in very dry years. When the worms don't do well, the flies won't do well. But usually people have this as a reoccurring problem every fall. And as I said, what I would suggest is about the first week of September for this problem to treat versus something like Asian lady beetles. Now is the time to treat because they come into a structure much later in the season.
Uh-huh.
There you have it.
So spray from the outside, and then that should kill them. Now, yesterday I bombed the inside of the screened-in mm-hmm. porch because I have my storms up for the winter. Will that kill them now for the rest of the year?
That will kill everything that's out in the living space. But
oh, okay.
Bombs will not penetrate into the walls, and that's why I'm suspicious there may be some flies. It's got to help, but don't be surprised if on the next sunny day, all of a sudden, there's more flies that have come crawling out from these protected, sheltered places.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And John in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
Question. A few years ago, I stayed in the southern part of the state in a guest house, and I had several bites that I were told were recluse spider bites. And it was my understanding, like you said, they weren't really indigenous to Wisconsin. But I did a bunch of internet searching, and it was a hobo spider. Do you know anything about a hobo spider?
Okay, this one is also one that it's interesting how our opinions have changed. Now, the hobo spider is the brown recluse equivalent on the western part of the U.S. because people were getting bites, but we didn't have the spider, and they equated it. But it's interesting, the original piece of research, they took a hobo spider, they crushed it on a rabbit, and the rabbit developed an ulceration. So the idea was that the venom is toxic and causes cell damage. But that experiment has not been able to be duplicated. And when you think about that, that's not a good way to do an experiment because there's potential contamination on the outside of the spider. So even the hobo spider now we're starting to believe is not responsible. The other thing I guess I would tell you, it is extremely unusual to get multiple spider bites. I mean, that's just not the way they work. And so I would be far more suspicious that something else bit you. And the question is, you know, there are lots of possibilities, bird mites, bat bugs, and on and on. The other thing that I tell people that's characteristic of spider bites is if you look at them very carefully, and you might need a little bit of magnification, but all spiders have two fangs, so there should be double puncture marks that you can see. What often happens, you may or may not feel the bite, but you often get a localized bruising reaction because the spider does inject venom when it feeds. And so, you know, to get a little swelling, a little soreness, last 2 or 3 days, it might take a week or two for the bruise to go away, but that's the classic spider bite. And as I said, if you got one bite on your toe because there was one in your bedroom slipper and you put your foot in there, that makes sense to me. But when people talk about multiple bites, I start looking for other culprits. There's got to be somebody else doing it.
Wow. The guest house had been closed up for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen more spiders indoors in my entire life.
Okay.
And as hard as we tried, we couldn't get them all out of there. And it was the most painful thing. I would have rather had my arm broke than had this bite.
Okay. Well, then, I mean, it could... Again, the reaction, and it's interesting because we all differ on how we react to the venoms, and so some people can have far more pain and activity. But again, the interesting thing is that when a lot of these have been investigated, it's been secondary infections of the bite that seem to cause the most serious reactions, more so than the spider venom itself.
Huh, interesting.
Huge hole. On a side note, do you know a good way to back out a tick?
If you look at the structure of a tick, I explained that its mouth part, we call it a hypostome, is like your thumb. It's a long structure, and it's literally barbed like a fish hook with multiple little hooks. And so in the case of a wood tick, it's a rather short hypostome and the barbs. And so if you pull slow and steady, it will often pull out relatively easily. With a deer tick, it's more complicated because the hypostome is much longer, so there's more parts of the critter in you, and they literally cement the thing in. So aside from being barbed, given the time, they will cement it in. And so it's almost impossible if a deer tick's been on you for 2 or 3 days to literally get that out with doing some kind of minor surgery or at least opening it up. So what typically happens is people will try to pull, they break it off. The complication there is like a sliver. It's a foreign body that could potentially get infected. It's no worse than that. Now, there's a research done at Ohio State tells us it doesn't matter if you put cooking oil on them, you burn them with matches and whatnot. None of those things aid in the release of the tick. But if you look at how their mouth part is constructed, it makes sense. They don't chomp on and hold on. They have to cut this thing in, get it inserted, and that often takes really a number of hours for them to do it. So as I said, a slow, steady pull. It doesn't matter if you turn them to the right or left. I mean, some people believe that they were like a corkscrew. You could that's not the way it is at all. So,
but it seems like all the home remedies, no matter what you put on it, they will not let go.
No.
Right. And as I said, because they don't have the capacity. It's not like a set of jaws that they clamp on and then can release. It, again, it's like a long stick that is cut in, placed in, and then the barbs hold on. And then, as I said, depending on some species of ticks, they literally glue it in on top of that.
And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a veterinarian I have on my show, she's got a little metal thing that she uses for removing ticks from animals. And it's small enough. It's just a little forked thing that bent a little bit. And she has it on her keychain. And she says it's very, you know, if you just slow and
and easy. The secret there is she's getting down at the base.
Yeah, she gets down at the base,
you know,
with it.
And so you're pulling from there, so you're pulling the whole body apart. And so it does aid in it. But as I said, it's with these barbs, I mean, they're fascinating things. Look at the internet sometime under tick mouth parts, and you'd just be fascinated the way these. In fact, that's how we tell them apart, is how the little barbs and hooks are orientated on the hypostome.
Just to go along with that a little bit, George in Polk County emailed us and wondered about the life cycle of a tick. Northern Wisconsin's had tons of them, and he was told they will return again after a frost, wondering if that's true as well.
Well, with the deer,
and does it apply to the deer tick?
Yeah, the deer tick, what makes them interesting is they're active anytime there is no snow on the ground. If it's above 40 degrees, they can be active. And so just depending how things go, and there is a life stage out there all the time. The life cycle in particular takes 2 years from the time the egg hatches until we get an adult tick that's mature enough. The adult ticks are active in the spring and the fall. The immature ticks are active in the middle of the summer, and they can all spread Lyme disease. And, you know, I think a message everybody's got to keep aware is Lyme disease continues to increase. We had 2,500 cases in the state last year. We only had 2,000 the year before. If we go back to 1999, we only had 400 cases. So it's been a continuing ramp up. I know my colleague Susan Paskowitz has been doing some work, and we're finding some sites where 4 out of 5 of the adult ticks are carrying the disease, which is mind-boggling, because historically it's been only 1 in 5, less than 20%.
So their life cycle is they
only feed 3 times.
Okay.
And as immature ticks, the very small stage that we call a larvae, they prefer rodents, and that's how they get the disease. Lyme disease is a mouse disease,
okay.
And they acquire it, and then the other 2 times they feed, they have the capacity to transmit that.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls now, and Phil in Wauwatosa is up next, so let's go to Phil. Hi, Phil.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Had something I observed a couple of months ago. I had a tool that had been sitting out on my front deck. It's one of those little 6-in-1 screwdrivers. It's got a little driver, and you put different bits into it. Well, anyway, it had been sitting there without any bits in it, so there's just this metal tube, a very quarter-inch diameter metal tube. And I went to put a bit into it and found it was packed with mud, dried mud, and
mm-hmm.
knocked all that out, and out fell 7 or 8 tiny little green caterpillars.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think was maybe some parasitic wasp had put them in there, that it made that my little tool into a nursery.
Yes.
That's exactly what happened. as a matter of fact.
We have all kinds of species, and most of them are very specific at the prey they catch. And what they're looking for is the equivalent of a straw in the environment. And so that could be an old bark beetle hole. It could be a hollow pith of a plant. And so that's what this creature found. And then depending on them, some of them utilize grass clippings in there. Some of them use mud. As I said, there's really a large number of species that do this, and so you created the right environment, and they were trying to take advantage of it. And what they do is lay their egg and let their larvae develop on their own with the food stores they've left there. They don't take care of it, so we call these solitary wasps versus the ones that live in a colony. Everybody works together, and it's a very common trait of solitary wasps. They're very docile because there's no true nest to defend, so they really honestly tolerate a lot more activity, whereas the true colony wasp, as you know, you go by with a lawnmower, you bump into them, they get pretty agitated. And there's a lot more of this going on than I think most people see. Sometimes I get calls, too, that the channels on people's window frames often get packed with grasshoppers or katydids or leafhoppers. It just depends what species of wasp that's out there.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Carolyn in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I was taught something this year in unusual circumstances. I was along the bike trail pulling ragweed before pollinated because of my allergies and a lot of people I know, and I'll educate anybody who comes by and show them what ragweed looks like if they're interested in what I'm doing. Well, anyway, so I was pulling and making a pile, and a bicyclist stopped, and looked at my face and said, looks like you need some of these leaves. And he picked the ragweed leaves off of the plants I pulled and rolled them into sort of a tube between his hands and said, just roll that on your face. And I did, mostly because it felt so good, because it was so itchy. Well, anyway, by the time I got home, it was, within 15 minutes, they were all gone. All the bumps were gone. And so I tried it three or four more times. I got mosquito bites on purpose and tried it. And the one time I waited 45 minutes, about, before I put some on, it didn't work. But It did work within, let's say half an hour. Anyway, so I'm wondering, will it, my theory is it draws out the anticoagulant. That's the only theory I've come up with so far.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Phil?
Boy, it's a very interesting observation. I'm going to have to pass that on to Susan because, she's worked with various things, mosquitoes. She does a lot of research with mosquitoes, and I'm not quite sure. I mean, it would seem that it's kind of difficult once the mosquito injects the saliva to get that out. It may be on the other side that it somehow affects your body's reaction so it doesn't overreact because, of course, most of the mosquito bite is our body trying to fight back to these foreign chemicals that are in there. And maybe it quiets down there, so it's more of almost an antihistamine-type reaction. But as I said, I'll pass it on to see if Susan's aware of it, because that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, and maybe it numbs it somehow, too.
You know, and definitely this year was a great year to test it, because, boy, the mosquitoes are about as nasty as they can get. So.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Carolyn, for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Packard joining me here for the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive. Our goal is to keep bringing you discussions with folks just like Phil Pelletieri, and we do that in large part with your contributions. Your gift, any amount right now, makes a big difference as we raise the money we need to make these discussions possible. So give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. We've made some inroads here, Jim.
Yes, we have, Larry. You know, you give at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 to help pay for the programs that you depend on. And so far, we've got 19 people who have pledged so far this hour, and that means that we're only looking at 51 more pledges, but we've got to do it in the next 10 minutes. So we'll hope that you go ahead and make your pledge right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. As I said before, you decide the amount of your pledge. If you ask for an Ideas Network 20th anniversary mug when you give $150 or more, you'll have the Cadillac of mugs. So pledge right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And you might wonder what your pledge pays for. Well, we have toll-free numbers, so you can call in with your questions. We have four of those. We rely on newspapers and magazine subscriptions, internet services, and all that so we can research the topics of the day. All these things and so many more have costs, as you well know, associated with them. Your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 helps pay for them.
Giving at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 is easy. All it takes is a gift of a dollar or two a week and a few minutes of your time. If you're wondering which payment method is the most convenient, let us recommend EFT, ongoing monthly transfers from your bank account. Once it's set up, you don't have to think about it. It's very cost-effective for WPR also. A dollar or two a week adds up to $50 or $100 for the year, and all year long you'll benefit from the program and all of the WPR programs you love. So make your contribution right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552 and give as generously as you can.
I love to listen to both the classical music and the Ideas Network stations because, it seems to me they're the only ones that are worthwhile to listen to. The Ideas Network gives opposing political views and allows us, the general public, to express our views about current issues. It's important for me to be able to come to my own conclusions about issues, and this is one way that I can do that.
And it's a great way to do that, and thanks a lot to that listener for those comments. As we are right in the first, the first talking day of our drive, we've had a couple of days that were set aside because of your contributions. Well, now we are in a situation where we need 48 more contributions to reach our goals. Pledge at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And I don't care how much you pledge. We had a $25 contribution earlier. Maybe your gift is $50 or it's $100, or we've had contributions of $500 in the past and $1,000. So whatever the amount you choose is the right amount. Go to WPR.org or call at 888-202-2552.
That's right, Larry. 48 calls are necessary in the next 6 minutes in order for us to stay on track in the drive. Thanks if you've already given. If you haven't, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge and ask for an Ideas Network 20th anniversary mug as your thank you gift when you give $150 or more at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin Public Radio keeps you informed and entertained every day. You get value from this program and also from Kathleen Dunn's shows and from Car Talk and What Do You Know? Don't Tell Me, Says You, Old Time Radio. So there's lots of others that you've probably come to rely on. We give you a window on the world like no other, and I hope you'll support this exciting mix of programs you enjoy on this station. Do it with your contribution at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552. 47 more to go, Jim.
That's right. Well, it's actually down to 45 to go.
All right.
So things are moving along. Christy from Appleton pledged, and she said, I have learned so much since I started listening. I just love your programming so much. Thank you, WPR. So consider sharing your appreciation of lifelong learning that you get from WPR by making a gift of $1,000. Your gift of $1,000, which is about $83 a month, will help to ensure that WPR is available to everyone. Of course, any amount is welcome right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And on the Ideas Network, you hear lots of different things. Lots of things on this program. We talk about insects one day. We might have an author another day. We talk health issues another day. A lot of advice-type programs. But on other shows, you'll get politics. We'll talk about popular culture and literature as well. It's a valuable service, and I think it's a service worth supporting. Your contribution, $50, $100, whatever amount you choose, makes these Ideas Network programs possible. So if you haven't pledged yet, please do it right now. Oh, we're down to 44. Please do it right now at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552.
Larry, both you and I know lots of people who have a habit of listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. They have a habit of listening, and they have a habit of donating. So pledge your support today. Renew that support each year. It's a good habit. It's a habit you can be proud of. So get it started today with your pledge of any amount at WPR.org. Or at 888-202-2552.
That's a great habit to get into. That's a habit I like. That's a habit I like a lot. I want to thank those of you who renew by mail or who make ongoing monthly transfers from your bank account or maybe from your credit card. Listeners who renew and the monthly sustainers really are our backbone and actually save us a fair amount of money just in terms of processing and so forth. If that's you, thank you very much. If you haven't given yet, I hope you'll join the other wonderful Wisconsin Public Radio members by donating now. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We have a goal of 70. We have 43 more to go, Jim. What should they do? What should they do?
Well, they should give right now
at WPR.org
or at 888-202-2552. We ask you to consider becoming a sustaining member by making an automatically renewing monthly contribution from your bank account or credit card. The more sustainers we have, the more stable we are. So we'll thank you by planting a tree in the Shawabigan National Forest on your behalf. And you can get all of that information right now by pledging at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Christy from Appleton did say, I want to support WPR because I believe in what you're doing with this station. You have an educational and informative, non-biased programs. I've learned so much since I started listening. I just love your program so much. Thank you, Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Christy from Appleton, thank you very much for your contribution, whatever that amount was. It is very, very much appreciated, as we appreciate any contribution of any amount. It doesn't make any difference if it's $25 or $50 or $100. We're looking for 43 contributions here in the next few minutes. Do it right now. Go to WPR.org, or you can call us as well at 888-202-2552. We're going to be talking with Phil Pelletieri into the next half hour. Obviously, he's going to be here to answer your questions. He's just one of the many people who come by with some great down-to-earth practical advice for you every day between 11 and 12:30. Now we're asking for your support. So give now at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552. You will be glad you did. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist Larry Mueller here. I've got to break in here. This is just in. We have a $1,000 challenge match from the Wisconsin Physical Therapy Association from now until 12:30. So they'll do a dollar-for-dollar match up to $1,000. So if you haven't contributed, I literally just was handed this. If you haven't contributed yet, go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And whatever amount you put in, up to $1,000, the Physical Therapy Association is going to match it. So a great time to double your money. Great time to do that. And Phil, we're going to go back to the phones. And Tom in Wanakee is up next. So let's go to Tom in Wanakee. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Say, last spring you recommended that I use the Bayer tree and shrub insecticide for my skyline locusts and a Marshall ash. I had problems with the aphids, and I used it, and of course around the base of the tree, the concentrate, and it worked great. I'm just wondering. I've been hearing that an application in fall might be beneficial, and I'm just wondering about your opinion on that. I've done it in April, mid-April, the past 2 years.
Sure. The thing we consider is when the insects are active versus when the application goes on, realizing that the product is not very water-soluble, so it often takes weeks to get into the tree. So for things that are active right away in the spring, it's best to treat in the fall, so it's already in the tree and active. So now would be a time to treat for anything that's active in April and May. If you have something like Japanese beetle that doesn't show up to the 1st of July, it's very appropriate to put the product on end of May, beginning of June. So as I said, I tend to time it. And since both the critters that you were wrestling with are pretty early season, you're probably better off putting it on now than you are in the spring.
It's really dry right now. Should I wait until after we've had some rain so there's better moisture? Okay.
In fact, that's the other side. If there's not sufficient moisture, it's worth watering in and giving it more water just because, again, it's by nature, it's not a very water-soluble compound. So it is slow to move, but once it's in there, it honestly holds for a number of months, which is one of the advantages.
Wouldn't hurt to water anyway because if it's that dry, you want to keep those plants hydrated.
Right, and so late October or whatever, before ground freezing would be still okay with moisture.
Definitely. Right.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Ken in Mayville, it's on to you now. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Been waiting all summer to get this question out to you. Back in, I'd say it was early May, end of April, I got a couple bites in my elbows and arms that they seemed like mosquito bites, and then they would just dissipate for a while, and then it would almost start itching out of the blue again, and would get a little bit of a blister, and then pop, and then it would be fine. And it did this over and over. Each bite did it like 3 or 4 times, and this went on for almost a month and a half. And, you know, I know chiggers kind of blister up, but do we get chiggers up here, and would they be out that early, and would it blister both consecutively?
Sure. We do have chiggers. They're typically more of a late summer problem. But because it reoccurs, per se, I suspect it's something that looks like a bite but is not, or there's another complicating factor here, because that's just not typical. Your body usually processes the stuff, it's done with it, and there's no way that there's venom or stuff left behind that should cause it to reoccur. So with that, as I said, you get suspicious it's bacterial or something else that is continuing to go through the cycles rather than being a critter bite. Or it could have been original critter bite and then, as they said, had some other complications. But it's definitely not typical of any creatures that I know that we run into here.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Linda in Egg Harbor, hello to you.
Yes, hi, thank you. I have a strange question, I suppose. Last winter, or maybe in the very early spring, in my indoor bathroom, I had an infestation of small black ants that seemed to be coming out of my electrical outlet. I didn't have them anywhere else in the bathroom. And then one day, the outlet just sort of sparked and started to smoke. And when I called an electrician, fell and the smoke was due to burning ants. And I'm just wondering if that's strange and how I can prevent that from happening.
The case of the burning ants.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a colony moved in. I mean, it depends on the kind of ant. Some ants just don't move, but we have some ants that have what we are called satellite colonies, where groups of ants will leave the main colony and they will exploit an environment. And if you look at the electrical box, that's a nice sheltered environment. And so we do get this kind of problem at times where the ants will move in. And, you know, even in the case of computers and stuff, even though it's not common, it does happen. And if the ants line up in touch one wire to the next, I can see it happening, but it's really quite unusual. It's not something that is commonplace here. I do hear about it down south with fire ants and whatnot getting into electrical boxes outside all the time, but that's something we don't find here. So I think it was just an odd occurrence, and I really don't think it's going to happen again. But one of the things you could look at doing is getting that sealed up. If you pull that plastic plate off, sometimes, you know, they sell these little pieces that use for insulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And something like that put in there would probably seal up the box tight enough that the ants can't get access. So that would be one thing to consider.
There you go.
Oh, thank you.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. And Derek and Tomahawk will take your question. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
This spring, I was prepping garden beds for vegetables and then a separate bed for flowers. And I noticed in two separate locations, after I had rototilled or scratched, scarcified the surface away to get the seeds to germinate, I noticed that earthworms were coming out of the ground, or small night crawlers, I'm not exactly sure, and they were being driven out of the ground by a small black bug. Maybe it was, maybe a half inch long, 5/8 of an inch long, shiny black, and it was biting the worms or night crawlers quite often. And I was curious if it was driving the worms out of its area or if it was going to kill the worms and eat them.
I would think the latter. I would think, you know, I'm guessing there might be some species of ground beetle, which are general predators that are common in the soil. And it wouldn't surprise me at all, them feeding, and the worms are doing their best to get away, but I'm guessing that the beetles are a lot faster than the worms.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Chris in Stoughton, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. A couple of weeks ago, around dusk, I observed something that I've never seen before. I wondered if you could give me some insight. We're driving along a highway in the field next to the highway. There were these narrow columns of what it looked like smoke, but then when we got a little closer, we could tell it was insects. And they were like 20, 30, maybe 40 feet high and very narrow columns, like I would say maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that was?
Yeah, to be honest, entomologists tease it's the insect equivalent of a singles bar. But what you've noticed is a swarm of males, and it's probably of some species of fly, although there are other critters that will do this. And sometimes they're in clouds, sometimes they're in columns and the like. And what happens is the females visit these collections of males and pick a mate. And it's interesting, some do it at certain light intensities. Some make these swarms over landmarks. So you'll see one 2 feet above this rock every afternoon for a week type of thing. So I know it's a swarm of something. It's just a question of what gnats it could be. It could be lake flies, it could be fungus gnats, and probably about 20 other things. So it was a collection of insects, and my guess is it was mostly males, because that's typically what you see swarming. And then, as I said, the females come to visit those and pick their mates.
Oh, it was just really interesting. There were lots of the columns. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Lori in Madison wonders, what would the spider be that would live near a lake and enjoy crawling into our boat?
Mm-hmm.
The best way I can describe him was big.
And ugly.
Light brown. Had a look like a dinosaur spikes on it.
There is a large, in fact, there's more than one species. Dolomites is the genus, but we call them fishing or raft spiders. And so they're quite common around water, but they'll go a good distance away. They can literally float on the water. They feed on small fish. They're very interesting creatures. And so I bet you it was one of these Dolomites spiders.
And Don wonders, how do you get rid of the inch-long, dark brown millipedes on sidewalks and outside walls of houses in the evenings?
Well, the thing to keep in mind there is that millipedes are out cruising at night, and they collect where it's cool, damp, and dark. So it's very common to get them on cement slabs in the driveway or the garage. But that's not where they're coming from. And so I usually try to take a step back and realize that they are a soil-living creature that needs organic matter. There's not enough organic matter in your normal lawn, but there may be a prairie next to you or a woods full of all kinds of decaying leaves. And so that's where they're migrating out from. And so that's where you want to set your barrier, is whether you put insecticide on with a drop spreader like you would for fertilizer, or you spray where you stop mowing and where this organic matter source is. And basically you head them off at the pass. I think it's a mistake to allow them to get to the house. Because concrete is a terrible thing to spray. It really doesn't hold the pesticide very well. The other thing is that the less organic matter you have around, probably the better. But since I see these migrate from as much as 40 or 50 yards away, sometimes the source of the population is not even on your property. So,
oh, there you go. Maggie in Wauwatosa, hello to you.
Hi. My question is about bed bugs. It's been in the news lately a lot. Now, we have a cabin, a totally uninsulated cabin in northern Wisconsin, Eagle River area. And every fall, late fall, we close it up totally, drain the plumbing. There's no electricity going into it or anything. So I'm wondering if there were any bed bugs in the mattress, in the bedding area, or bedding up there, if it would get cold enough to freeze them, if that would have any effect whatsoever.
Sure. A couple thoughts. To be honest, if you were to find a bed bug there, I would suspect it's not the human bed bug, but a species associated with bats, which will bite people but not breed off them. But interesting enough, there have been situations where there are summer camps that are very similar. They're closed up for the winter, or they're in upstate New York and other places. We've even seen them in Wisconsin, that the bed bugs have survived. So no, and the problem is it doesn't get cold enough fast enough. But with that being said, my question is, I wouldn't expect bed bugs to show up there unless somebody brought them in on used furniture or brought them in on a suitcase from a house that was already infested. So that's a very unlikely place to find bed bugs.
So you're probably safe. If you haven't found them yet, Maggie, you're probably safe. Maureen in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Maureen.
Yes, hi. See, a few years ago I had read that dragonflies were... it seemed as though they were almost getting to be extinct. And then about the middle of September, I was standing out on my front porch. Well, first of all, I like to say that I noticed an unusual amount of dragonflies in my yard this year.
Yeah, that's that. They really had a good year.
And then about the middle of September, I'm standing at my front porch about 6:30 in the evening, and I see these, they actually look like clouds of dragonflies that are going over the house.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been a couple hundred of them. And I was wondering, are they migrating?
Yes.
Or?
Most of our species, and we have, I think, about 55, 60 species, might even be a little bit more than that, of dragonflies in the state. Most of them breed here locally, but we do have the one species in particular that does migrate south, not quite as far as the monarchs, but going down to Kentucky and the like, the green darner dragonfly. So it could have been that, or we do see these collections at times of dragonflies that are feeding together on swarming ants or other kinds of creatures, and so that would be a possibility. But the extinction side, I have not heard that. There is a particular couple species that live in very restricted environments, and they're not doing so well because of habitat destruction. But generally speaking, the dragonflies are doing well, and I always argue that they deserve more good press because they're far better at eating mosquitoes than the birds are.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a challenge grant, a $1,000 challenge match from the Wisconsin Physical Therapy Association. And so we were asking people to call in because it was doubling their money. And Jim Packard, we've done it. Jim's joining us now.
Yeah, we did it, Larry, without twisting their arm or pulling their leg. And we thank all of them who responded to that challenge from the Wisconsin Physical Therapy Association. Now, we also have a goal of 23 calls to make our goal of 70 for the show. So 23 more in the next 10 minutes is where we are at right now.
And I'll tell you what. We need the money to pay for programs that keep you in the know and entertained. And kind of that's how WPR works. The people who use it help to pay for it. So asking you to go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 right now to ensure the program, the future of the programs you count on. And we have 23 more contributions to go to reach our goal of 70 for the program. So 23 more to go. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And Jim, we need those 23 in what? About the next...
In the next 8 minutes, in order to meet the goal that was set for us at the start of the show. And we want to thank Arnold and Ellen from Madison, who called in with their pledge. Thanks if you've already given. So if not, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now. WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge. If you ask for a Ideas Network 20th anniversary mug, that means you've given $150 or more. At WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Phil is certainly one of our most popular guests, and I know you've been enjoying the conversations that we've had with Phil about insects, and I hope you'll take a few minutes now to make this hour and the many hours to come possible. Put a value on the programs you enjoy every day and then make your pledge. Phil's come up with some great advice today. I really liked his advice on what to do if you're traveling to keep the bed bugs away. Put your suitcase maybe in the bathtub at the hotel or at least in the bathroom. Well, that's one I hadn't heard yet, and it was great advice. I'm going to do it. And I also make pledges, and so does Jim Packard. We both pledge. Make your pledge now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Lori from Weston has found out that giving couldn't be simpler, either at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. All we need is your name, your contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you'd like to pay it. If you use a credit card, if you can, it will save both you and WPR time and postage. Or better yet, sign up for automatic sustaining donations from your bank account. Don't worry, we will not share your personal information with anybody. Give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Well, I think it's an investment in your own brain. I mean, I'm a retired person now, and as you get older, you do realize you need to keep your brain flexible. And even when I was younger, it's good to keep your brain flexible. And investing in public radio, in Wisconsin public radio, really helps me to keep my brain up to date and gives me different ideas and different viewpoints. Wisconsin public radio is my source for a better life.
And, you know, it keeps my brain going, too. We do on this program about 250 shows a year with about 400 topics. And I really enjoy being here and being able to contribute to the program in my own small way. And I'm here to ask for your support. Again, listener support, big part of the program. And it's a program that I think you really enjoy, and it's available to you right now. I hope you'll make your donation, your contribution in support of the programs you count on. This program, I hope you count on this program. Give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.